Welcome to Gettin' Legal With It, a podcast for Colorado young lawyers by Colorado young lawyers. I'm your host, Kevin Chaney. For those listening to us for the first time, I'm a personal injury and criminal defense lawyer here in Colorado. I graduated from the University of Colorado Law School in 2014 and founded my practice, Chaney, Galuzzi & Howard, LLC, a short time later. I'm a member of the Colorado Trial Lawyers Association, where I co-chair its new lawyers division and also serve on its executive and legislative committees. I'm a member of the Colorado Criminal Defense Bar Association and also the Colorado Bar Association. For the Colorado Bar Association, I serve on its Board of Governors, the CBA Young Lawyers Division Executive Council, and finally, I was just appointed to begin serving on the CBA's Executive Council. If you're interested in learning more about any of these wonderful organizations, please feel free to shoot me an email at kevin@cghlawfirm.com. This podcast is created and sponsored by the Colorado Bar Association's Young Lawyers Division. Our goal with this podcast is to bring you bi-weekly episodes with information that is both fun and informative for young lawyers. We have some awesome guests lined up, and we're just getting started. If you like our podcast, please, please, please leave us a review and tell your colleagues. With that, let's jump right in. My guest today is actually someone who's pretty well known to me since he's my landlord, Jay Camlett. Jay concentrates on real estate transactions and finance, as well as complex real estate loan workouts and restructuring. He makes connections amongst clients and others that make deals happen. Over the course of his career, Jay has negotiated more than $15 billion worth of property divestment and joint venture agreements in Colorado and other states. Welcome to the podcast, Jay. We're so happy that you could join us today.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
How's your day going so far?
Phenomenal.
I like the energy and I like that you're fired up. Before we get kind of into some more substantive things, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself? Who are you and where are you from?
So I'm Jay Camlett. I have been practicing law for 30 years, graduated from CU Law School in 1989, grew up in Denver, have experienced a lot of the things that Denver has experienced over the last 50 years, 56 years to be exact. And I think I'm preeminently qualified to discuss whatever we're going to talk about today. Because I've seen...
A man not lacking in self-confidence. I like it.
Because, frankly, if you don't believe in yourself, who in the fuck is going to believe in you?
I agree. Let's start... I guess a little bit at the beginning, what made you kind of want to be a lawyer? What drew you to the interest of law?
So I have an older brother that's a lawyer, and at 5 years old, I thought he was the coolest dude ever. And I thought, I'm going to be a lawyer. And I went to school and undergrad. I became a finance major, and I was going to graduate in 1985 from Drake University. And I said to my mom, I'm not going to be a lawyer yet. I want to be an investment banker. She's like, oh, what are you doing to me? You're giving me a heart attack. You know, traditional Jewish mother, like, oh, you're such a disappointment. Anyway, so I took a year off to some investment banking, realized that I'm really not that big a numbers guy. So
sounds like an important part of investment banking.
Yeah, a little bit. So I went back to – I applied to law school at CU Boulder, 1986, got admitted, and went to law school to try to avoid life for a few more years, right, like we all do.
Sure. And did you have an idea when you went to law school what kind of law you wanted to do, or was that something you figured out after the fact?
No, I totally wanted to be a securities lawyer and a real estate lawyer. Securities and real estate, okay? So 1986, Colorado is in the midst of one of their worst recessions ever, okay? Colorado at the time, you have to consider that there was only two industries here in Colorado, oil and gas, real estate. And all those older buildings that you see today, built in the 80s, were based on the belief that that oil and gas would continue to thrive. Well, mid-80s... oil goes down to the tank, $10 a barrel, and Denver's economy goes to shit. So I'm thankfully in law school, and I see all this. I see this boom and bust cycle of Denver, Colorado, you know, just the general Midwest is just, we're pathetic. We have no idea of what we can do with what we have to offer. So I start bouncing around thinking about what am I going to do when I get out of law school. I get a job, thankfully, in D.C. I want to do real estate and securities. So 1989, pop out of law school, go to D.C., the biggest metropolitan, you know, lawyers per capita.
The lawyer mecca.
The lawyer mecca. And all of a sudden, they're f***ed because the recession from started in the Midwest, expanded to the coasts. So people who are building garden apartments 70 miles outside of the D.C. area, who were calling themselves D.C. suburbs, were going bankrupt. So my class in my law firm, a brilliant law firm, started, I don't know, 50 f***ing years ago. Anyway, they were about 300 lawyers when I joined them. My starting class was 35 lawyers. Okay, this is out of law school, Yale, Harvard, Brown, pick the Ivy League school.
Sure.
So, you know, got the job, took the job. We spent about a year f***ing around with learning how to be an associate, which asked we had a kiss, you know, who was going to take care of us, who was going to throw us in the grease. So after the first year, the economy goes to shit. The what was called the junk bond market, the junk bonds, Michael Milken, if for those young enough to or old enough to remember that name, goes to jail for inside trading. And all of a sudden, 35 people become 5. They kick out 30 of my classmates, Harvard, Brown, Yale, Columbia, really. And the fucking schmuck from CU stays because I saw this coming. I moved into what was called the loan workout and bankruptcy practice, which was the big thing in 1990, bankruptcies, workouts. Hey, I remember driving with my then wife and my new baby, driving down Wisconsin Avenue, the richest per capita county in the country at the time, Montgomery County, Maryland, and pointing to my wife which buildings I was either being foreclosed on or foreclosing on for some bank.
Right, right.
So I'm like, let's get the f*** out of here. I don't like anybody in D.C. They're all f***ers. Let's go.
Head back to Colorado.
Let's go back to Colorado where things are going to start picking up.
Right.
Finally.
When you came back to Colorado, did you go into big law right away, or did you found a firm at that point?
No. I'm at this point, I'm 2.5 years out.
Okay.
I felt I needed somebody to keep holding my hand because I was a product of the late baby boomers and needed, you know, somebody to show me that I was better than I really was.
Well, even to this day, I mean, I think there's a lot of pressure to go join a firm and to work for somebody else. There's steps you do. I was just talking about it on another episode with someone who, you know, missed OCIs and thought his life, you know, might have been over. You know, I didn't get a job. I didn't do this thing. I completely missed it. He ended up making a pretty good career for himself. But there is, I think, to this day, a pressure. And my partner and I felt it when we told people we wanted to start opening a firm, you know, pretty much after graduation. There is a pressure that there's a right way to do things. Go be an associate, work a bunch of hours, get promoted to partner, work even more hours, maybe make equity partner one day and work even more hours. And then if you have any time left, retire with your millions.
Yeah.
You know, well,
that's all f***ing bullshit. It was then and it still is now. So,
right.
So yes, I came back to a wonderful firm, a firm that many people on this call will know, Brownstein Hyatt, went back there to become one of four associates out of 35 partners. And this was after a big upheaval in that firm. And there were 35 partners and maybe three associates.
Wow.
Yeah. But this was 1992, and they were starting to grow again because they had been decimated by the late 80s recession. And they're like, okay, we're going to start building again. So I came in. I was one of three associates. I was doing government contracts, litigation, real estate, environmental. I mean, whatever the f-
they yeah, I was like, with that many partners, you were probably doing everything.
Correct.
You were doing everything.
Correct. Insurance defense. I mean, it was crazy. And as that firm, as I was growing in that firm was growing itself, they're like, we need you to specialize. And I said, well, I really like litigation, but I really like real estate, but I really didn't like the f***ing litigation partner because he's a unfortunately, he's dead. I'm sorry. I hope he rests in peace.
No one left to offend.
But I love the real estate lawyer. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to go with the real estate side. So went to real estate, 93, 94. Things are popping. You know, new developments are happening. And I'm like, this is cool because you could negotiate and, you know, there's not a lot of regulations. And so I just built my practice based on real estate. And built it up to the point where I was up for partner in 98, 99 and said, all right, this is cool. I've been fighting the big fight. There were, I don't know how many lawyers there were at the time. There were probably like 40 associates at that point and, you know, equal number of partners.
Right.
And you think about when you're at an associate ranks, you're like, all right, you've got some really sharp elbows. You know, you got to fight your people. You know, you want to be friends with them, but you got to prove that you're better than they are.
Sure, sure.
And then you become partner, and then you realize that, well, I just climbed up this steep cliff with all the sharp elbows and knees coming up, and then you get up there, and then like you make partner, and you think, all right, I'm here. And all of a sudden, like, no, there's a whole big hill right above there where the
brand new ladder.
Where the elbows are a lot sharper and the knees are a lot harder. So 99, I started thinking, my third kid, I was going my third kid, and I'm thinking, if I don't make a move now, I'll be rich and happy and satisfied. Okay. But satisfied doesn't work for me.
No, not good enough.
I need to be fulfilled. And I was not going to be fulfilled there. And as great a firm as it is to this day, I was not going to feel like I was really a contributor.
Right.
So started a law firm in 2000, August of 2000, me and another guy from a big law firm, Patton Boggs, at the time. And we were going to build the preeminent law firm here in Colorado. And we spent the next 7-8 years doing that. We were 50 lawyers in 8 years. We were 50 lawyers, office in D.C., office in Minturn, Colorado. I mean, you know, $15 million a year book of business. We were rocking and rolling. And then shit happens. Partner goes off the rails. Several partners go off the rails. People start leaving. Economy sucks, recession starts.
Right.
And all of a sudden you're like, you realize you can't control everything.
Right, right. No matter how much you do or how hard you work,
right,
you can't impact, you know, society, right, your partners, everything else.
Right. So 2009 was the worst, 2009, 2010, worst f***ing days of my life, okay? I have to fire... We're at 50 lawyers, 25 staff. We probably reduced by half. My partners and I are walking around the office in March of 2009, literally firing people in twos.
Everyone recalls, that was right at the height of kind of that recession.
Huge.
That was not a good time to be a lawyer. At least went, not in all practice areas.
Right. I went from a $2 million book business a year to $200,000 if I was lucky.
Wow.
And literally, I was firing people whose stories I knew. You know, a single mother of four taking care of their grandkids and the kids. I mean, this isn't good stuff.
Right.
This is like you are potentially putting somebody on welfare, putting on somebody on unemployment, whatever it is. It's not an easy decision. It's not some cold-hearted, well, you didn't deserve it anyway kind of decision.
Right, right, right.
Nobody deserved what we were giving them.
Right, right.
But we couldn't support them anymore.
Sure.
And save ourselves. So here's the 2008, 9, 10, 11 recession. And we're down to about 24 lawyers, handful of staff. We find this silly little law firm out of Kansas City to take us lock, stock, and barrel. They're not little, but they're, you know, now they're about 230 lawyers whose name won't be mentioned here for their own sake.
Right.
And they're like, yeah, we'll take you. I'm like, okay, great. And they're like, but your names can't be on the name on the firm. I'm like, yeah. Take my name off.
Yeah, I'm done. I've learned my lesson.
I never want to see my name on the newspaper again, in a paper, in a press, whatever. Because every time, for the first 9 years of my practice, whenever somebody in my firm did something great, my name was up first. And every time after that, when things started to turn shit,
your name was up
my
first.
My name was up first. I'm like, please stop putting my name up there. So here I am with experience between, you know, the 80s when I wasn't really into the 80s recession, but seeing the impact of the recession and responding to it when my time came to respond to it. Then, you know, we also had the 9/11 recession, yep. the internet bubble, 2001.
Yep.
Listen, I've seen all these dips, but every time there's always an amazing, amazing turnaround. The Great Recession, 2008 to 2011. What I decided to do was to get the fuck out of big law and say, I'm going to build an environment for myself where I can surround myself with great lawyers, not have the obligation to pay them as employees or make them partners, but to include them into my universe.
And so just before we get to that story, I to complete your journey in big law, correct me if I'm wrong, but you actually managed to make it all the way to the top, right? Weren't you like the managing partner or the partner in charge or something of that?
Oh, yeah. Partner in charge. Yeah. For Lathrop. Yeah. I was the partner in charge. That was like the bottom of my life.
It wasn't a lot of responsibility and not a lot of fun.
I called it the babysitter in charge because I had to take care of all these prima donna,
all the drama,
all these little f***ers who thought they were like, we're the big like you have no idea what you're doing, but you have some good connections. You've done some good things.
Do you think it was the recession that caused you to want to maybe leave big law? Or do you think even if the things had continued well, like, you know, economically, you would have eventually made the same choice? Like, I've got to get out of here and go back to where I was.
For sure. You know, anybody who has an entrepreneurial spirit in themselves won't follow a traditional path. And that's the beauty. I mean, not a lot of lawyers have an entrepreneurial spirit. They went to law school. They thought they'll learn the law. Everything else will fall into place. The reality is what law schools didn't teach them, which they're now starting to, I think, is to say, hey, you need to take care of yourself. You need to be a salesperson. You need to sell yourself because what you are is you're selling your services. As a human being, as a lawyer, you need to be able to connect with people on a personal level as well as a professional level. Unless you connect on a personal level, the professional level will never come. Because if nobody likes you, they're not going to listen to what you have to say.
You know, it's kind of an interesting in, you know, our culture where everything is business, business, business. But in a lot of cultures around the world, it's actually considered rude to kind of discuss business that quickly. And I think it really is that philosophy of that. Before I talk business with you, I need to find out who you are as a person. Like, can we connect on a human level? Can I trust you on a human level? Like, what are your values? What do you care about? Because only then do I really have context to understand whatever sales pitch or marketing idea or merger or deal you're trying to pitch me. And if we can't, you know, understand ourselves on the personal level, then the business stuff is never really going to work.
Totally agree. You have to be a great human being before you can be a great lawyer or whatever it is you're doing. Because frankly, even in law firms, what people are seeing today, and particularly today, is if people don't hire law firms, they hire a lawyer in the law firm. And so, Kevin, if it's, hey, listen, Cheney Galluzzi has got a phenomenal reputation. They've knocked off 99% of their cases. They're killer. But if your client can't relate to you, Kevin, or to Tim, then I'm not going to try to hire those guys because, you know, my ass is on the line, whether it's financially or my liberty. If I can look you in the eye and you tell me I will do my best for you and not make any false promises, I will go with you 99.9% of the time.
We've talked about it a little bit on this podcast, and I think it's actually on another one of the episodes that we were shooting today as well, about how important authenticity is in huge sales. And people are always like, well, how do I say it? And what words do I use? And I'm like, you're asking the wrong questions. Yes, especially in litigation, there are, you know, techniques of how you form a good cross-examination question and how you, you know, do an opening statement. But when you talk to jurors afterwards about, like, you know, what they were actually persuaded by. Like, they may be a guy, you know, on one side who's bumbling and stumbles over his words and doesn't have any charisma. And the other guy, you know, is super charismatic and whatever. But at the end of the day, they'll be like, oh yeah, well, that guy was the better lawyer, but I actually picked the bumbling, you know, kind of idiot guy, type guy. Like, we awarded money to his client. And then you ask him why, and you really dig down and you find that he was believable because he wasn't trying to be somebody he wasn't. Like, if you're a person that, you know, likes to dress up really fancy and, you know, be very not articulate, but, you know, be in that world, then do it. But if you're not that person, even if you're interacting with other people who are, it's going to come off as fake and not genuine, you know? And like, Tim and I, Tim is my partner for those listening. We often talk about, you know, the way we speak to clients or how we communicate to clients. And some of my other friends are like, oh, I would never talk to, you know, someone like that or say something like that. I'm like, yeah, but that's who we are. And so it comes off as genuine. And because it comes off as genuine, it's persuasive. Like, they trust us because they know I'm not, you know, blowing smoke somewhere, you know. And I think that for young lawyers and law students that are listening, that is a really important thing that doesn't always come naturally to people.
I would add to that 100% what you're saying. Vulnerability, showing your own vulnerability is an amazing message to whomever you're speaking with, whether it's a jury or whether it's a client. You know, listen, yes, they want confidence, but at the same time, they want to say, hey, I can relate to what you're doing. I'm vulnerable in that I'm not some cold-hearted monster, you know, or machine, robot that is just going to make the argument the most logical argument. You need to relate to whomever it is you're speaking with.
Absolutely.
And vulnerability is another attribute that I would tell your listeners to tie into. The more you can show that you understand their situation and how you yourself have suffered or are vulnerable to those things, it's an amazing, amazing tool.
It's really cool to hear you say that because obviously my practice is all litigation. And so I go to a ton of litigation seminars, trainings, colleges, some of the best lawyers in the country. And that's the message that they preach, and that the, you know, Jerry Spence has, you know, arguably the greatest litigator to ever live. And his whole thing for weeks is, you know, almost like this weird form of group therapy where it's all about just discovering who you really are, you know, and that was his whole message, is that until you understand who you really are, the flaws, the good, the bad, and not the stuff that you normally show people, but like the real deep stuff that you may not necessarily share. Until you can get that out and be comfortable in who you are, you will never be persuasive. And it's so funny to go to like his, I have not been to his specific college, but I've had a lot of friends that have, and it's a 3-week course. And they're like, very little of it is on the actual in the courtroom stuff. Cause he's like, that stuff you can learn in a day. You can read a book, you can watch someone do it. But you know, you really want to be good, you really want to be persuasive, you better spend the next 2 or 3 weeks just working on yourself. And so, you know, I know as someone who's now a deal lawyer, you know, someone who negotiates transactions and real estate contracts, it's interesting to hear that it's the same, that it's really, really the same at the highest levels of deal making and the highest levels of litigation, that the Absolutely. People who are really getting it done are the people who know who they are.
Right, because you don't really care about the person on the other side until you care about the person on the other side. It's just a cold transaction. When you start listening to the other side open themselves to, you know, you think in today's world, I'm not going to get into politics, you know, you just got to be the aggressor and you got to be the killer and, you know, them at all costs. And that doesn't happen. That's anybody who professes that, you should walk away, tell your client to walk away from that deal, or tell their opposite side, get rid of that lawyer because we're not going to deal with them.
So we've talked a little bit about kind of some advice I think that is applicable to people at all stages of their career and really all types of economic times. But I want to turn the discussion a little bit to, you know, we are in the midst of what has a chance to become the worst economic downturn in American history. I don't know whether we'll beat the Great Depression, but we are right there. Yeah. And you, as obviously we've discussed, you know, you've survived and thrived in, you know, kind of several different recessions. And so what advice, I guess to start, what advice do you have to law students and young lawyers who may have just lost their job, may have had lots of really, really good law students that I know have had their offers pulled, their world has come crashing down on them, and they're scared. And what advice do you have from them to kind of begin to pick up the pieces and to, you know, keep moving forward in the legal profession?
So this, to be cliche, the sun will come out tomorrow, right? There is, I don't know what the time frame is, but this is not a time to panic. This is not a time where you think you have to reinvent yourself. Take what you have, take the skills you've learned, and what I call is remarketing yourself. So when my real estate practice crashed in 2009, because there were no big deals going on, I remarketed myself. I took the skills that I already had and remarketed them into being a workout specialist, meaning I'll go to the lenders and I'll explain to them that they have no clue what they're doing with this property, that they should leave the property with my client, the borrower, to let them try to restructure and reimagine the potential of the property. So it's a remarketing effort. Don't try to learn new skills. Now, that being said, I have a friend who is an environmental lawyer who's originally a chemist who is now going to take the patent bar in chemistry. So, you know, again, it's not a complete renovation of his career. It is more of a remarketing of the skills he already has. So I tell you to remarket the skills you've already brought to bear, whether they're legal, whether you had a career before your legal career or a passion that you had before your legal career that you've always kept a low burner on. Just figure out a way to remarket those skills, those passions. Passions are the key, because if you're just trying to make a living, you're not going to be that happy about it. Remarket your passions and find that area that you really, really love. If you're a corporate lawyer, but you always loved nonprofit work, go become a nonprofit lawyer and use your corporate skills. If you're a real estate lawyer and you really love real estate, but there's not a lot of deals, go be a developer or reimagine your legal skills as a development lawyer.
Do you think that obviously, you know, in times of boom and bust, there are practice areas that kind of go up and down. Do you think it's good advice, especially for a law student or somebody, you know, who hasn't even started their career yet? Do you think it's good advice to kind of hedge their practice areas? Like, do you think real estate and bankruptcy, you know, make a decent combo? Because either, you know, it's rare that both real estate and bankruptcy are down. You know, does it make sense if you're a 2L to, you know, take one of those kind of, if there is a recession, this could be some skill sets that I could have?
I definitely would work on the debtor-creditor side at this point and figure out, even if you're in real estate or in commercial or consumer, bankruptcy, workout, foreclosure, landlord-tenant work. You look at the downside of a business cycle. So business cycle generally is going to have ups and downs. So on the upside, you could do real estate, corporate, tax. Tax is always good. If you're smart enough to do tax, you're fine, regardless.
Listen up, young people. Tax law.
Tax law. Tax law. So on the upside is, you know, transactional side. On the downside, all right, there's bankruptcy. There's creditor, debtor-creditor work. There is litigation. These kind of times, negative times, bring a lot of things out of the woodworks when it comes to, I've been really pissed off at my partner, but now things are going down the toilet. I really want to show that he or she was not the great actor.
Right.
So litigation. You know, you've just got to look at the business cycle generally. Don't worry about the law side of it. What in business is going up and what in business is going down? I mean, look at aerospace now. I've been following this stock called Maxar, which is a satellite company that does all the photo images for Google. And I've been following them, and they've been muddling around 7 or 8. And that launch, the private space launch that SpaceX
yep.
did, they're double where they were 2 weeks ago because now people are interested in space.
Right.
So you have to watch the general trends in the business and general community. And so if you're interested in telecom or space law, this is a great time to be doing it. Even though the economy's in the toilet, space law is big because now Elon Musk, the freak he is, has proven that he can do his private space flight.
Any other practice areas that you kind of see as up and coming? I had Todd Rogers on the program a couple months ago. That was right before COVID kind of started to hit. And he is the Associate Dean of Career Development up at CU Law. And I asked him kind of the same question, like, what if you were a 1L and they were asking you what practice areas to kind of be booming? And his what he thought, there was going to be a lot of focus on privacy and data, that there was going to naturally be a development of a lot of privacy law as, you know, Facebook, Google, all of these companies kind of exist based on our data, and that's how they make money. And he thinks that, you know, we've already kind of seen that trend in Europe, a lot of privacy regulation, and so you're going to need regulators, lawyers on both sides, plaintiff, defense. Any other practice areas that you kind of see as a practice area of the future, if you're a 1L right now, that hey, you may want to get involved in this.
Wow, that's hard. I'm not a futurist, as many people hold themselves out.
We said space law, and I think that is space, I think that's a good one. I think
space,
that's a good one.
Aeronautics, space. I think data privacy, probably everybody's already crammed into that, honestly. I'm not discounting the efficacy of that. When I was coming up, intellectual property was huge. You know, Ellen Riley was the only lawyer in our class that was focused on intellectual property. I was like, what the hell is that? You know, you need to look for yourselves on what you see coming into the future. I would look into intellectual property and virology and microbiology and the things that are now are the most important things to us is how do we protect ourselves from these viruses and what are the technologies and the medicines that are going to help us there. I think data privacy probably at this point is overdone. Sure, there'll still be a great role for that, especially as now we're starting to do contact tracing and all these things. So, you know, it definitely is not going away, but I think the people that have already been into it are into it. I think climate change is still going to be a phenomenal.
One that's not going away.
It's not going away, and nobody there, you know, who knows what laws should be around that. And then, you know, just general, listen, people still need to run their daily lives. And if you can figure out a way to help people run their daily lives easier without a fear of making a mistake, great.
And you know, it's funny, you never really know when one of these is just going to explode. I know in speaking with quite a few people that with COVID-19 coming out, trust in estate lawyers saw kind of massive booms because a lot of people, I think, realized their own mortality and were like, man, I need a will, you know? And huge. So my fiance's mom is a trust and estate lawyer out in California, and she said that it was unreal just the amount of business that people had called in just because they were thinking about death, you know, and they hadn't been the last month.
Yeah. No, that's a big, big issue right now. I think our in Law Bank right now, the busiest practice areas are trust and estates, people doing their wills or revisiting their wills and estate plans. I see family law, unfortunately.
Family law is kind of recession proof. Family law is one of the ones that, right. You know, a lot of competition and it's a tough practice area right. If you can't handle the emotional baggage that comes from it. Totally. But that is a very recession-proof.
Yeah, and the complexities that have been added to it because of the stay-at-home orders and the, well, should I send my kid to my ex's house because who knows where they've been kind of thing?
What's your take on, and I was discussing this with another guest as well, on generalization versus, you know, high specialization. Obviously, if you live in a small town, you're going to be a generalist. But if you live, for the most part, if you live in a mid-sized city or a city, you know, for example, we were talking about someone who does family law or someone who does like LGBT-focused family law or somebody who does, car crashes as a personal injury lawyer or someone who does like Uber and Lyft crashes. And when I first started my firm, I thought, oh, I got to be a generalist because I got to get all these different kinds of cases and like, you know, I need that money. I can't turn that down. But as I've gotten better at marketing and gotten more experience, I tend to think that the people that really are crushing it are those that have been accepted as like the best or second best in the area in that one thing.
Okay. So specialization has to happen. You have to be a specialist in a few areas. What you need to then do is to then surround yourself with a community of lawyers that might do other things, LGBTQ or Uber or those things that, you know, you may not have that specialty and you need to be generous in, hey, listen, come in to help this client. You know, we'll work out a structure on the compensation, but I cannot be the jack of all trades. Unfortunately, even in a small community, you cannot be a generalist anymore. The laws are too complex. They're too fine. They're too refined. And you need to then surround yourselves with people that you trust in those certain areas that will crop up from time to time.
And I do want to talk a little bit about LawBank. Obviously, full disclosure, I office at LawBank and Jay owns LawBank. But it's been really great for my partner and I, who started a firm as basically fresh out of law school. So I guess I kind of want to take it back. Why did you start LawBank? Like, what need did you see that kind of needed to be filled?
All right. Well, so 2011 comes. So middle of the recession, I had just merged my law firm with this Kansas City-based firm. People were leaving what was my previous firm left and right because this firm was a real law firm and they expected their hours done. And, you know, they wanted, you know, you to be a lawyer first and a human being second, okay?
Sure.
Whereas my old firm was human being first, lawyer second. And literally, it's about 2 a.m. I'm about 3 sheets to the wind in my home office. And I'm like, I got to get the fuck out of here because I can't take it anymore. I think the recession is completely resetting the whole legal environment. And so essentially, I was like, all right, what can I do that, one, doesn't have employees, two, doesn't have legal partners, and three, if I could avoid clients, I would. But I can't because they pay the bills.
Sure.
So that's the internet, right?
Yeah.
The internet is all this nebulous world out there, and people will buy shit. And,
yeah.
Well, I didn't know that because I'm not smart enough to. I still can't even turn on my computer. So I'm like, all right, what about executive suites for lawyers only? So I started looking into it, and I started to build a business plan around. Hey, let me create, because I knew I wasn't going to go to another law firm, because that's the grass is never greener on the other side.
Right.
What can I do to create an environment for myself where I can go solo, but not be alone? Because being alone, which the last 2 months have proven to me, would mean I'd be about 500 pounds, my dogs would be about 300 pounds, and I would be at the refrigerator more than my computer. So I started to put together a concept of a legal ecosystem where it was all independent practitioners, different practice areas, different levels of experience from coming out of law school to people looking to retire, and build it just like a law firm, but none of the bullshit. You don't have the politics. If you want a corner office, pay me for the corner office. Don't stab your colleague in the back to get to it.
Right.
Please show them how much better lawyer you are than they are. And so put together the business plan with a great partner, Jordan Dyfick, phenomenal dude. And we were like, we're going to build a whole brand new mousetrap. And so we started this in 2000. We rolled out our first location in 2013. And we invited people to come and participate in this, from the person out of law school like you and Tim to the lawyer like a Bruce Featherstone, who's one of the most phenomenal attorneys in the country, who's looking to retire but may want to pass on some knowledge to a younger generation. And so we built this community. It's an ecosystem. And what we're trying to do is to grow this ecosystem outside of Denver into a larger Colorado community, into a larger U.S. community. I'm going to go out to Vegas next week to look into a location next week. And right now we're about 115 lawyers. I'd be the fifth largest law firm in Colorado if I was a law firm. But I don't, you know, I don't owe my tenants anything other than a commitment to help them achieve their goals, make sure their computers are working, the heat's on.
What do you think, And, you know, I kind of already know the answer to this based on my own experience, but I'm kind of interested on your take. Why do you think LawBank or other models like it are such valuable resources for a young lawyer?
Community. People need the sense of mentorship, community. Just if I was at a law school, I was so afraid, and I'm sure everybody out of law school, even today, no matter what the generation is, I'm a baby boomer. You're probably a Gen Xer, and
I'm technically a millennial. I'm an old millennial.
You're a millennial.
I know.
What's the new one these days?
Z, I think.
Z or Gen Z or whatever.
Could be Gen Z.
You know, I think for my generation, the baby boomers, I was just in awe of anybody who was older than me. And I was in awe of anybody who ran a law firm. And I was afraid of anybody who had a degree and had a profession. I think your generation and below are like, hey, I want to meet you. I want to meet you where you're at. I'm not afraid of you, but I want to meet you where you're at. And I want you to tell me if you're going to help me in my career or if you're just going to be a dick. If you're a dick, I don't want to deal with you.
Right.
But if you're going to help me where I want to go, I want to listen. And that's the difference. There were a ton of when I was getting out of law school. I mean, they were miserable fucking pricks who I wouldn't let them mow my lawn, let alone want to listen to their advice.
Right.
But they were just older than me.
Right.
And so I had to respect them because they were partners in the law firms I were at.
Sure.
I was at. Nowadays, you know, if you don't like what I have to say, you're like, okay, I'll go listen to somebody
else.
Go
to the next guy.
Next door to the next guy. Right. See you next.
Yeah.
Was that the Ariana Grande?
Thank you next, I think it
thank
is.
Thank you next, yeah. Right. So, and that's beautiful. That's what I love about your guys' generation, is you don't have that fear that I had when I was coming up. You know, I'd go into a big office building and have to walk through a electronic turnstile and think, oh, this is really cool. You know, it's this image they projected.
Right,
You guys have totally pushed out to the side and said, if you have something to offer me, I'll listen. And if you don't, then f*** you.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. And I think it's kind of a product of just how easy information is to get. You know, like it is still, and I stress this all the time on the podcast, it is still essential to have mentors and actual people to speak to you. But like we also live in a world now where a lot of the information that you used to have to ask somebody about, you can find on Google. You know, you can find it on social media. You can just read it. Like, I don't have to deal with personalities. Like, I can just go straight to the information. And of course, you know, you're never going to be able to have the complex conversation with, you know, a computer, at least not yet. I shouldn't say never because we absolutely probably will. But as of now, you can't still have that complex conversation that you can with another human being. But there isn't this wall, I guess, that's up to like keep us from the information, to keep us from that knowledge,
right,
that we need some specialized gatekeeper with a title to really, access. And I think that's been an interesting change.
But to your point there, that same thing with your clients. They don't need you. They can get that information too. You need to show them as a lawyer why you can add more value to what they can find on Google.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because they can pull out, you know, how do I respond to a whatever complaint.
You need, it depends on the practice area a little bit, but a lot of practice areas are competing against like LegalZoom and some of these things where they can get it way cheaper and, you know, quicker. And they don't have to talk to anyone. They don't have to feel like they have to dress up to go into this big fancy office. And it's refreshing, I think, to kind of have that easy access. One of the lawyers that I respect, I consider him the next Jerry Spence, if you will. There's a guy by the name of Nick Rowley who wrote a book called Trial by Human, talking very much about what we were talking about earlier. But his thing is, first of all, he never meets clients in his office. He always goes to their house and he never wears a suit or tie. He'll show up in casual clothes and he always goes to their house. Now, Nick's got, I don't know, 900 million in verdicts and like houses in 13 countries now. But, you know, so he has a little bit of a different practice, but his whole thing is like, my goal, I need to learn everything I can about this client. And if they come into my fancy White Tower office and I'm in a suit and they, you know, work for, you know, whatever, making 30 grand a year, they're going to be intimidated and they're going to shut down, just like you kind of feel when you're at a doctor or somebody else. And so when I go in and, you know, dress normally and meet them on their turf, like, it's amazing how much more I can learn about them as a person, which then turns me into this like effective advocate. You know, you don't need all the pomp and circumstance, at least in a lot of practice areas these days.
Yeah, I just got a client the other day who's like, well, how good are you at negotiating with the landlord? Like, I don't know. Depends on the landlord. You know, I mean, but as I started to ask him the questions, I'm like, let's run a trial case. What about this, sir? You know, if I tell him that you're going to do, you know, you need this because you got to give me some good reasons why you need that.
Right.
I can't fill that in.
Right.
And I literally was like grilling him, which I don't do very often. Right. I just said, here, what about this answer? What about this answer? He's like, wow, I'm really glad you are, you know, looking on the other side. On that, in that case, it was, I benefited, I add value to my client because I was, if I was on the other side, I'd be asking these questions. So listen, the end of the day is be a great human being, do the best you can, be creative. Creativity is going to be the key. There's no fucking new normal here, okay? You need to take what's given you and be creative around it. You need to build your success around whatever's thrown at you. And it's not going to be looking back at what somebody's done before. You need to find creative ways. This podcast for you, Kevin, awesome. Cheers to you, brother. And, you know, for doing this. And the other members of your team and your generation. Because this is, you know, I was afraid. I thought I was going to have to be in my office. I was going to have the Zoom, my camera, I had to fix. And you're like, come down to the basement of where.
No, we got our man Rick behind the scenes, who is always crushing it for us. So anyway, big shout out to Rick for helping us out here.
So these are the kind of things that are going to be immensely helpful to you, your generation, your firm. You know, I've always been impressed with what you and Tim are doing to stay fresh. And that's everything. Staying fresh is going to be the key. And don't fall back into, well, this worked before.
Right.
Nothing that worked before is going to work going forward.
Well, thank you so much, Jay, for coming on. I like to end each podcast. What is a good email address if any law students or young lawyers out there are looking to get in contact with you, either to pick your brain, ask you about Law Bank, ask you about real estate, ask you about your affinity for curse words, you know, anything that they want to chat with you about? What's a good email for you?
So the initial J, Kamlet, K-A-M-L-E-T, at kamletlaw.com. And I really do encourage anybody to reach out to me. I did something for the DBA YLD a week ago and had several people reach out to me, fed several Zoom calls with them. Zoom cocktail hour is my favorite.
Yeah.
With them subsequently. And, you know, listen, I want to share whatever wisdom that I have, if you call it wisdom, or experience. I'll call it experience. Wisdom is a loaded term. But I certainly have a lot of experience, and I want to share it with people who are truly interested in taking that wisdom and growing their personal development. I promise you I will not discount or every question in my mind is a good question, so.
And I would highly recommend law students, young lawyers, take him up on advice. Jay has definitely been a mentor to me during our time, and I think he's got a lot of really good info to pass on to the upcoming generation. So thank you so much, Jay, for coming on. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Awesome. Get legal with it.